friends. Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we're coming to you from the west coast of Sverige. You can hear us every Thursday and Sunday through our website, redicecreations.com. For this Sunday program, we had our regular guest Alan Watt scheduled to come on for his monthly spot, but we have not been able to get in contact with Alan today. And these things do happen. I guess it's nothing more than a conflict in the schedule, and I hope that everything is okay with Alan. So what we're going to do today is to listen to one of our subscriber interviews that we did with Peter Lavenda back in February this year. The subject is on his excellent Sinister Forces book series, and we are continuing from the regular program in this subscriber interview. And in case you want to tune in to that first segment, just head into our radio archive, go down to the month of February, and download. We archive all of our shows, and our regular interviews are all up there for free for you to enjoy. Our next program this coming Thursday, we have Michael Tesserion back on the program. And until then, do take it easy. But now, let's enjoy this subscriber interview. Welcome, subscribers. We are speaking to Peter Lavenda, and I basically want to continue our conversation. We've been speaking with Peter for about an hour on our regular program, and diving into the subjects of his book Sinister Forces, a three-volume set, excellent stuff, diving into the grimoires of American political witchcraft. But Peter, to get things going in this segment, we kind of left things off a little bit, speaking about Crowley and the connection to the UFOs. One thing that I've kind of been pondering about is regarding the fact that Crowley died in 47, and this is kind of the same time that we had the Roswell crash in New Mexico. And have you kind of find in your work that there are kind of synchronicities, so to speak, in regards to the time or the timeline, if you will?
Well, I do. I see 1947 as kind of a watershed year. In that year, we had the first real UFO phenomenon in the 20th century. I mean, the creation of the term flying saucer was in 1947. Just about a month or so before the famous Roswell crash, we had the sightings of the saucers over the Pacific Northwest. A pilot by the name of Kenneth Arnold saw them and reported them as looking like saucers skipping across the waves. And that's where the origin of the term flying saucer came from. Mm-hmm. And that was in about June of 1947. And then there was the Fred Crisman case, which happened directly after that. And there was a lot of spooky stuff going on with Fred Crisman at the time. It looked as though he was working for an intelligence agency because of the way he set up certain meetings with Kenneth Arnold and with two Air Force intelligence investigators who went to investigate the Crisman UFO sighting and who wound up dead. They had taken a box of debris from Crisman that he claimed was UFO debris. They got into their airplane, and their airplane crashed, and the officers died, and no one knows what happened with the debris they had. Then, a little bit later, we had the Roswell crash. At the time of the Roswell crash, the Nazi generals that we had spoken about earlier, Dornberger and some of the others, were taken directly to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. In those days, it was just Wright Air Force Base, I believe. Mm-hmm. So they were taken directly to Wright, and where they... it was assumed were the people who were put in charge of examining the UFO debris. So in the same month, we have Nazi generals going to Wright-Patterson to investigate the UFO debris that was taken from Roswell. Mm. And then in that same period is when the CIA was created, and the National Security State, essentially, in the United States was created in 1947 with the National Security Act, mm-hmm. which the CIA was a spinoff of. So we have all of these events happening at the same time. And then, of course, we have Crowley dying in December 1st of 1947. Mm-hmm. So it was a kind of watershed year in a lot of areas.
Yeah.
Parsons and Hubbard involved in 1947. Hubbard conjuring spirits in the desert in California with Hubbard. I mean, bizarre things were taking place in 47, and with Parsons declaring that he was the Antichrist,
yeah,
and was going to oversee the you know, the destruction of the old world and the birth of the new.
Yeah.
All of this taking place at the same time, in the same year.
It's amazing, and you know, I know that this is a very, very difficult question in that sense, but in regards to the UFO, you know, phenomena, have you in any way been able to kind of pinpoint this more, or had, you know, just found that more questions arise when you research it?
Well, I find a lot more questions than answers, and my tendency has been, I mean, I keep changing my mind on this thing because I come up with new information. But I've often wondered if the whole thing was not some kind of an American intelligence operation. Not that UFOs do not exist. I believe that the sightings, many of the sightings, are very suggestive of some kind of phenomenon, and these go back many years, long before there was an American intelligence apparatus. So
yeah.
I'm not discounting the entire field. But as far as the late 20th century experience, it seems to be ridden through with intelligence operatives, people with agendas of their own. And when we talk about Guy Bannister and Fred Crisman and all of these guys who were later involved with the assassination of Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
having cut their milk teeth, as it were, on maybe disinformation activities concerning the UFOs, that seems to make me wonder if there is a deeper connection.
Yeah.
I don't know, quite frankly. I've spoken with, for instance, Whitley Strieber, the author of Communion, and about his experiences, and he's perfectly willing to entertain the idea that the experiences that he had might have been the result of a military disinformation or brainwashing campaign of some kind. I mean, he grew up around Randolph Air Force Base,
which
is where the Nazi scientists were based, especially the ones involved in medicine and psychiatry.
And he even has a chip in his ear, I think.
Right, which they found. I mean, which exists.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what does all this mean? You know, where do we draw the line here between what is UFO fact and what is UFO fiction? There's obviously a UFO fact database somewhere. I mean, of things that genuinely take place.
Sure.
As for the rest of it, I don't know. How much of it is part of the national security apparatus that we now have in our country?
Yeah. Could there be a kind of a merger between the two fields, in the sense that we actually have had genuine sightings from the start, from the get-go, and genuine people who are, you know, having these sightings and so forth, but then later on we have the you know, the defense industry kind of taking, I guess, using the people and using the field in that sense to kind of you know, in a way that there actually are engaged in some kind of psyops in connecting with the UFO phenomena and all of this, and connecting, I guess we can even draw in the MK Ultra program, connecting that with the with LSD use and all of this stuff. Do you see a connection between the two?
Well, I do. It's just that I'm having a very difficult time trying to get the entire picture in my mind. I'm like one of the blind men with the elephant, you know. And I keep running around to different parts of the elephant trying to put this picture together, but the elephant keeps moving, and that makes it a bit more difficult.
Yeah, indeed.
But definitely, you know, there is something going on. I mean, there is an element of, well, let's put it this way. The disinformation campaign has been very good.
Yeah.
They've caused so much confusion in the minds of researchers and the population in general that we can't tell, you know, we can't separate out anymore the fact from the fiction as try as hard as we might. Every time we think we know what's going on, we get thrown another curveball, which means, in my way of thinking, there's something definitely real taking place behind all of this. There was a definite UFO presence in America. Something definitely did happen, but there's been so much smoke that's been blown around since then that we're having a hard time seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in itself is an indication of the seriousness of the UFO contacts we might have experienced in this country.
Yeah. Indeed, you know, another thing here regarding, I guess, if you want to use the term magic, I mean, in your work, have you discovered that this is something real that actually does work in the sense, or, you know, is there a difference between something we would call stage magic or, you know, in quotes here, real magic?
Well, absolutely. I mean, from my point of view, magic is a definite, is a reality. It is a technology. The way I approach magic is as a technology of consciousness. I think it's a technology that underlies organized religion. Organized religion couldn't have existed, in my mind, without magic. Magic was the forerunner of I think, all supernatural experiences, whether you want to call it magic or mysticism. I mean, there are two different paths.
Hmm.
One is more mechanical, which is magic, and one is more devotional, you might say, which would be mysticism. But they're based on some of the same technology, to use that term.
Hmm.
And I think, for me, it's a technology. And we used, in our own country, we used remote viewing deliberately during the Cold War to identify locations of Russian submarines and things like that. So we had psychics actually in the employ of the military, but average people being trained by the military to become psychics, to locate foreign defense installations, to try to influence the minds of foreign leaders and that sort of thing. And that's been pretty well documented. We can't avoid it. We can't avoid the fact that supernatural means have been used in our country, and by not just the United States, but in other countries around the world. The Soviet Union had thrown a lot of money behind psychic research as well.
Yeah.
So what we call magic, it's a loaded term, and it's one that if we continue to use it, we're going to be accused of being the kind of people who wear aluminum hats, you know. I would like to take it out of that realm if I could, just and call it a kind of technology of consciousness, and I think that in that case, yes, it works. People like some of the famous physicists who have been investigating this kind of phenomenon that I talk about in Sinister Forces have made presentations to the Defense Department showing how quantum consciousness, for instance, could be used by the military. Andrea Puharich was making presentations. He was one of the original nine, and he was making presentations to the military as to how the paranormal could be used as a military weapon. So weaponizing consciousness is something we've been involved with at least since 1950, if not earlier. So our government believes in it to a certain extent. Our scientific community believes in it to a certain extent, perhaps to a deeper extent than we're aware of. And I think that humans around the world should be aware of this and should defend themselves against it by studying it themselves, because this is a field which the government knows just about as little or as much as the rest of us. I mean, they're still pretty much in an experimental stage with this. So I think that we can make a contribution to our own defense by learning what these guys are up to and how they're doing it.
Sure, yeah. You know, if we were to, I guess, look at the top of the pyramid, so to speak, you know, at the, I guess, people who build and run nations and so forth, do you think that at the top there is a common goal, or are we having a world where we, you know, still have, you know, very powerful but fighting nonetheless branches of where we are to kind of go in regards to where the world is, you know, headed, so to speak?
Well, that's a good question. And it's a difficult one to answer.
Yeah.
I have a tendency to believe that the leaders of our world, our political leaders, are themselves not necessarily the ones who are calling the shots where this is concerned. I have a tendency to believe, since they're so replaceable, whether through assassination or through voting or through any other means, that these are not the stable figures who are the ones that we should be afraid of.
Mm.
Although they make decisions that ultimately affect us all, and sometimes in very negative ways, I still don't think they're the ones who are really the ones ultimately in power. I think we should look at a documentary that Bill Moyers did during the Iran-Contra affair about 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he called it the secret government. And here's a guy who is not that gullible or credulous. Here's a person who worked in government,
mm-hmm.
Who worked at the White House, and then turned to investigating, you might say, the paranormal and religion. He was the person who, of course, who interviewed Joseph Campbell at length. Here's the same guy back in during Iran-Contra who privately, it appears to be privately produced, an expose of a secret government in the United States. So he believed there was a secret behind it.
Hmm.
He believed there was a secret force operating in our country at the time of Iran-Contra, at least. And then he started to research it further back. So I think we have to pay attention to these guys. I think Bill Moyers was onto something, and some of our dearest conspiracy theorists are as well. I think we should just pay more attention.
Yeah, indeed. You know, one thing that comes to mind, of course, also is you earlier spoke of kind of the high note or the convergence of the, in that sense, the grand conspiracy being the JFK assassination. And I mean, the more you speak about it, I tend to go into that direction too, considering all the connections that seems to lead to this point. But one thing, of course, that I see as a kind of a high note in regards to, you know, a cultural event or a disaster, if you will, is of course the destruction of the World Trade Center on 9/11 2001. And is this something you go into in your book series, Sinister Forces, at all?
I don't go into 9/11 very much, except to mention it in passing and to talk about terrorism in general, particularly what's come to be known, unfortunately, as Islamic terrorism, which is a misnomer, naturally. But we have a tendency in the United States, because of our media, to assume that Muslims are by nature terrorists. This is something that we have to work against and try to elucidate the reasons for this kind of thinking. But there was an organization back over 1,000 years ago called the Hashishin, or the Assassins, from which we get the word the assassin, word assassin, the Assassin's Cult. And this was, I wouldn't say the first terrorist organization, but probably the first intelligence operation. Here we have a group of Shiites, a disaffected group of Shiites, actually, a strange sect within Shiism, who were called the Ismailis. And this group of Ismailis in particular were the Assassins, run by a man called Hassani Sabah. And he was able to overthrow governments, foreign governments around him, by sending assassins in to kill their leaders, or at least to threaten them. And he trained his people very well. They spoke different languages. They dressed appropriately for the people they were presuming to be. It was an excellent terrorist intelligence operation, if you will. So we had, you know, roots of that kind. But then to jump from there to 9/11 is a different story for me.
I
see the same sinister forces at work there, with nothing to do with Islam. If we think back to the Columbine School massacre, for instance, here's a good example. We have these school children in high school murdering all of their classmates and teachers in the most horrific case of a school massacre in our history in the United States, in Colorado. And they had planned on their websites, one of their plans after the massacre was to hijack an airliner and fly it into the World Trade Center.
Oh, really?
And this, they had planned this a couple of years before 2001. And then there was a short-lived television series called The Lone Gunman.
It
was produced by Chris Carter of The X-Files. And these were characters from The X-Files, The Lone Gunman, who ran a magazine, a sort of conspiracy theory magazine. And the very first episode of The Lone Gunman involves flying an airliner into the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
So, to me, this is evidence of the sinister forces at work.
Yeah.
This was planned in advance, but not necessarily by those 19 men who were flying the planes, and not necessarily by Osama bin Laden. It was in the wind. It was being created in human consciousness before it actually took place. Or, conversely, the event that took place sent ripples throughout space and time, essentially, throughout the past and the future, which is an idea in quantum consciousness that events send ripples in both directions, both into the past and into the future. So it's perhaps possible we were seeing the event before it happened.
I mean, yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. You know, I've been pondering that back and forth also regarding the fact that, you know, they, in quotes here, actually have to kind of, as you say, plant these events in the form of fiction. And if that is the case, do you think that helps to make an event that they actually want to have real to become more real, or actually that someone, I guess, is you know, I guess we could be talking about copycat effect and so forth and all of that, but considering that the timeline here is so very short, I think the Lone Gunman was the same year or something like that. So I mean,
about a year.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, do you think that this is in regards to the magic, as we spoke about of earlier, could this be one of the methods, so to speak, that they actually, you know, plant this in fiction form first to make it real later?
Well, we're going back to Lovecraft again. Lovecraft, in his stories, wrote about the artists being the first ones to sense an event before it happened and unconsciously recreating or creating the event in their art as a prefiguration of what was about to occur. What came first, the chicken or the egg? I'm not exactly sure. However, there's another example. We had an occasion back in the 1960s where a young Marine went up into a tower in a university in Texas, and from the tower of that university, he started killing people using a sniper's rifle. He started shooting people at random until he was finally captured and killed himself, I believe. This event was prefigured in a novel that was written a couple of years before, almost down to the exact detail, including the name of the captain of the police force that apprehended him and stopped the massacre from occurring. This kind of thing happens. And is it a question that the forces that be are creating a fictional reality as a kind of template, as a kind of magical ceremony? You know, it's a little bit like sticking a pin in a doll and hoping that the person will then feel pain.
Yeah.
The old spellcasting technology.
Voodoo,
is it the same thing? When we write a story, when we write fiction, are we creating a possibility for these events to take place a little bit later in the future? Are we responsible then for actions that take place later? The question of responsibility is one that concerns me a great deal.
Hmm.
You know, are we responsible for creating it, or are we simply seeing in advance the events that are going to take place?
Yeah.
And that's a question that has yet to be answered, but it's a question on which the whole practice of magic relies, I believe.
Sure, absolutely. One of the things also, I guess, that is interesting in regards to our modern culture is, of course, if we go into numerology and this kind of stuff, I guess we could connect this with Kabbalism in one level or another. Is numerology or Kabbalism anything that you go into in your books?
Only briefly here and there, just for when it turns out to be interesting. For me, Kabbalism itself is an area of intense fascination for me and study. The idea that by using words and by permuting words, we can cause change to occur in consciousness. I mean, this is what Hollywood does every day. This is what Madison Avenue does every day. We are constantly using words to alter reality, to create virtual realities. And we do this as writers. Obviously, anyone who writes a book or an article is attempting to alter the reader's reality to a certain point or a certain extent. And a radio program like this does the same thing to its listeners. There's a kind of a collaboration that takes place between a reader and a book or between a listener and a radio program. So there's a kind of Kabbalah that's at work there in that sense. So that does fascinate me, the idea that the written word can be used to effect change, which is what the Kabbalists believe. They believe there were codes built into the Bible, of course, to the first five books of Moses.
Yeah.
So the idea that there was coded information that we don't quite see is something that, it's the world we live in today. I mean, we live in a world where we believe that we're not being told the truth exactly, and we're not being lied to exactly. We're being given the information, but it's in a coded form, and we have to decode the code. We're trying to decode 9/11. You know, there's a lot of groups out there who have serious reservations about the official story about 9/11. And those reservations are compelling.
Indeed.
The Tower 5, why did that go down?
Building 7.
To take that down, you know,
et
cetera, et cetera. Yeah. How did the towers really fall? Was that logical that they would fall straight down the way they did? On and on and on. There's a lot of data there.
So indeed.
We think we're looking at events that have coded information, that there's a secret message being sent to us, or that's embedded in historical events, embedded in the texts that we receive, whether it's a CNN news broadcast or an ancient book on Kabbalah. You know, where's the information coming from? What does it mean? And how urgent is it for us to decode that message?
This seems to be, I don't know if you have any take on this and so forth, but kind of the there's a lot of people, you know, acting up regarding the year 2012 and all of this, and in regards even, I guess, to the 9/11 event, in regards to that we're, you know, I guess living in the end times in that sense, whatever that might mean for people interpreting that term. But in regards to you know, your own view on that, Peter, have you kind of Do you think that there's a program running in that sense that actually is coming to its close, if I'm to ask you that question?
Well, that's another tough question. 2012, of course, has figured for a long time, and I've been looking at it, and a lot of others, of people that I know have been looking at it as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to understand it. Obviously, according to the Mayan calendars, this is an important date. It does signify the end of a major cycle.
Yeah.
But what does this mean? When we study astrology, for instance, cycles begin and end without, you know, tragic events necessarily occurring. We don't know. We feel that we're in a period of tremendous decline, environmentally, spiritually, and otherwise. We feel there is, you know, a reckoning of some sorts coming up.
Mm.
But I have to hasten to point out that we've gone through this before. We've gone through this with the year 2000. Various religious groups go through it all the time, figuring by their calculations the world's about to end, and it just doesn't.
Mm.
So I'm trying to be optimistic about 2012, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I think it's the only way I can wake up in the morning, so I'm trying to be optimistic and feel that maybe 2012 will be the end of a cycle, but it might be the beginning of a better one, and that's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah.
So I don't want to frighten anybody with all sorts of dire predictions. I simply don't know. I've listened to the psychics, of course, and I know there's all kinds of predictions of world cataclysms and
yeah.
that sort of thing
yeah.
for 2012. There will be, you know, alignments of planets around that time, I believe in May, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm not entirely sure that's all going to be a bad thing yet. And I think it needs a little bit more research. And anyway, we're only a few years away.
Exactly, yeah, sure.
I think we're going to find out long before we're able to finish the data gathering.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting to hear you know, what people think of 2012. It's part of the I guess collective, you know, undercurrent in that sense. I mean, I've been elaborating on this with previous guests on the show that either the case, you know, as we were speaking about earlier, this is such a big part of many people's life now, so they're focusing on it so much so that something might actually happen on that point just because of that.
Well, that could be it. I mean, just like all of the other things we've been talking about, when you create the template, you create the idea in people's minds, and sometimes things happen because of that.
Yeah.
Maybe everything we've been discussing is like that or stems from that. It's an occult kind of thing.
Yeah.
But remember all the consciousness we had about the year 2000 and the 2000 bug, the Y2K bug, and everything coming to a grinding halt and nothing happened. You know, so it's possible that we have this idea in our head that there is a date in the future where things are definitely going to change.
Yeah.
And we're projecting this. But 2012, remember, is a South American calendar observation. I don't think it's really been supported by Western calendar mythology, shall we say, for instance, Kabbalistic calendars or the others. I'm not certain. I'd have to really look into it a bit more.
Mm.
But it could just be this is one group that sees it that way, and it may not be reflected in other mythologies around the world. So,
sure.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
I'm going to wait and see like everyone else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's yeah, great. It's a very difficult subject in that sense. I totally agree. You know, another thing, I heard your interview with Whitley on Dreamland. I can remember about 6 months ago or something like that, maybe.
Okay.
Anyway, in that interview, you spoke a little bit about, you know, you went into a little bit more about Hollywood and the one thing that you know I kind of reacted to was that there are different acting techniques in regards to, I guess you were referring to mind control methods and the way that people, that actors, you know, use their techniques to get in the mode of you know their characters and so forth.
Sure.
Maybe you'd like to elaborate a little bit on that.
Well, I found acting itself and the process of acting fascinating for that reason. Stanislavski, of course, created what we know as method acting. And Stanislavski spoke a great deal in his writings about mysticism. He referred to Indian, Hindu forms of mysticism a number of times. And he compared what he was doing to a kind of mystical state. And I think when we talk about method acting, we're talking about a person who puts their consciousness entirely in the consciousness of that character. So they alter their body language, they alter their speech patterns, they do everything. They create histories in their mind for the actor, which is not written in the script, but they develop this entire life story for the actor so they can become the actor completely and lose their own sense of identity. This, to me, is a kind of voluntary possession, or what I refer to in Sinister Forces as voluntary madness. We undergo willingly a dislocation of our personality. We create an alternate personality. And my reading of the MKUltra documents, those that have been released, there's about 10,000 of them, most of which are meaningless accounting forms, but there's some meat on the bones. And what I've been able to find out is that the CIA was deliberately trying to create a kind of multiple personality disorder, or dissociative identity disorder, in their mind control subjects, trying to split their minds so that they would have one personality, which was the normal, everyday personality that you're born with, and another alternate personality. And the alternate personality would commit the assassination or whatever other crime was necessary, and then forget about it. The other personality, the original personality, would have no memory of this. This is very close to method acting. The only difference is that an actor normally would remember that they had played, you know, the role of Willie Loman on Broadway or whatever. They wouldn't forget it. But the CIA wanted you to forget that you ever acted in that particular role as a courier or as an assassin. So to me, the relationship between Hollywood and the occult is very strong, because actors are engaged in some of the same technology and the same practices that priests of different cults and magicians have been involved with for centuries. The CIA simply wanted to create and control that process themselves and decide who would remember and who would forget, whereas within an initiatory framework, you never really forget what you've been through, what you've gone through, and that's the major difference. But Hollywood, because they manipulate reality, and they manipulate consciousness, they're in the same business.
Yeah.
You know, they're in the mind control business, basically.
Do you think that, considering the fact that, you know, so many people want to, you know, make it, so to speak, in Hollywood, there are, you know, I mean, scores of people crowding to, you know, get a part in some film or whatever, but could the collaboration between these two go even deeper, considering that this might be the kind of perfect testing ground for subjects, you know, Hollywood, for all those people who might not, or actually might succeed in Hollywood, meaning, you know, that they can pick and choose at some length, you know, at some length, to which persons they actually, you know, choose to use as these mind control victims. Because as I understand it, there are, you know, they are looking for people who are easily manipulated, I guess, in that sense, because there is a different, people are different in regards to how they can be controlled and so forth.
Certainly, I believe you're right. I believe that if we look at the documents that we have and the testimony before the various commissions on mind control, like the Rockefeller Commission, one thing stands out. There were two places where the CIA conducted these experiments on unwitting subjects, and that was New York and California, which are the two places where we have the largest concentration of actors.
Yeah.
We have New York City with Broadway and all the live theater and movie making, and of course we have California. And I believe that the wannabe actors and actresses, the ones who don't make the grade, have actually sometimes a greater need and a greater passion to be accepted. They're not accepted for a number of reasons. I mean, Hollywood is very choosy about who it puts on the screen. So it could simply be because one looked better than the other one physically, or whatever the reason was. So you have a huge pool of people who have studied method acting, who've gone to all the acting seminars, who've been trained in this already. All they need, really, is a guru of some kind to push them over the edge and to manipulate them more successfully. We've had a lot of very spectacular homicides in Hollywood. I mean, the Manson killings, again, to go back to Manson being one of them. We're involved with the murder of an actress, you know, and the actress's friends. You know, and Sharon Tate did act in a number of occult films. You know, her acting was in Eye of the Devil, for instance, in the UK. She was involved with the Vampire Killers, a Polanski film. I mean, she was involved in occult films and was known to have associated with people who were involved in the occult. So we have that occult Hollywood connection, which has always been very strong. Marilyn Monroe was very interested in the occult.
Yeah.
You know, there's photographs of her with psychics and astrologers and things.
Yeah.
So we have this tradition in Hollywood of an occult connection. Scientology focuses on Hollywood celebrities, as we know.
Yeah,
created a special division just to handle the celebrities and the approach to celebrities. So it's a natural. So when you see Tom Cruise or John Travolta or Kirstie Alley or any of these others, you know, you have to think that, you know, the fact that they're actors and have been involved with method acting and have been involved in losing their consciousness and trying to change it into someone else's, that these are the perfect people to be used in any kind of a military or an intelligence capacity.
Fascinating. You know, your blurb for book three called The Manson Secret, you have a short paragraph states, you know, simply David Lynch and spiritual transformation. I think throughout the entire book you go into this more regarding, you know, the assassination of Marilyn Monroe, Jim Morrison, Phil Castro's Hollywood career, but this line stands out to me, at least, because I'm so huge fan of David Lynch. would you like to elaborate more on what you mean by that, David Lynch and spiritual transformation?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm also a very big fan of David Lynch as well.
Mm.
I've called him basically the last true initiate making films in Hollywood. I believe that where we talk about spiritual transformation, this is a focus of Lynch in particular. Lynch is always talking about transformation in his films. You just have to catch it. In the very first Twin Peaks episode, as an example, there's that famous exchange where there's a man in a hospital room, and we have our agent, our FBI agent, Cooper, and we have the local police officer, Truman, obviously, very funny thing as well.
Yeah.
So we have Truman and Cooper sitting in standing in the hospital room talking to a man who has knowledge of where Bob, the serial killer, is located.
Mm-hmm.
Before they start talking, the overhead lights blink on and off, which is a David Lynch trademark, the lights that don't quite stay lit. And Mike, the one-armed man, says, looks like we have a bad transformer. And a bad transformer is for me the hallmark of most of David Lynch's films. A transformation that doesn't quite take or is somehow derailed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an initiatory process which has been corrupted in some way. A bad transformation,
uh-huh.
A bad transformer.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's that was MK Ultra. You know, this was what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because the CIA were not a bunch of initiates. They did not have spiritual training. They were looking only at a mechanistic view of the human mind and the human soul.
Yeah.
They started to cause transformations to take place, but they were bad transformers, and it was bad transformations, and your result is the serial killer. Your result was Bob in the David Lynch film in Twin Peaks, so you have a bad transformation, and I think that's the hallmark of it. Henry Lee Lucas, very famous serial killer,
mm-hmm.
A man who claimed responsibility for hundreds and thousands of crimes. Here is a man who was stationed as a prisoner, sent to Chillicothe, which is a famous federal penitentiary on the site of Indian burial mounds. You know, and he was there at Chillicothe at a time when CIA was conducting MKUltra experiments at the prison, using massive amounts of drugs, dosing prisoners with huge amounts of LSD that would, I think, kill any normal person.
Yeah.
All of this really unsupervised. All of this done with human beings as guinea pigs. And then their identities are destroyed because the documents are destroyed. We don't know who was treated this way. We don't know the transformations that were taking place in these individuals. I mean, when you're taking LSD, it's a bit like a shaman taking mushrooms or peyote.
Mm.
There are supernatural and psychological ramifications, implications
for
all of this.
Yeah.
And transformations begin to take place. But if they're corrupted, your result is a Henry Lee Lucas or a Charles Manson or Bob in the Twin Peaks episodes. So I think when we talk about Lynch, we're talking about somebody who knows about transformation somehow.
Yeah.
He has an instinctive knowledge of this process.
Indeed, very interesting. You know, one thing I'd just like to finish off on here, regarding another movie and I guess a religious theme, if we can connect this with the use of LSD or different drugs and so forth, is of course regarding Jacob's Ladder. Is this anything that you go into at all in your book or in your research?
In my research, definitely. The movie made a profound impact upon me when I first saw it. A beautifully done film that talks about what we talk about in the Holy Alliance and in the initiatory process in general.
Mm-hmm.
Drugs inducing psychological states. And here we have a Vietnam soldier who has been wounded in battle and is now experiencing his death in stages, and he's resisting it, and he has experiences of demons and of angels until finally he reaches the state of redemption. That's the cover story, but there's another story within it, which is the story of the drugs used to cause this change in consciousness.
Mm, yeah.
The military used drugs in Vietnam in different areas and on different types of people. On their own soldiers, yes, they used BZ, which was the drug that's referred to in Jacob's Ladder.
Mm, yeah.
They also used experimental drugs on Vietnamese prisoners of war. CIA was very involved with MKUltra in Vietnam, using prisoners as guinea pigs without their consent whatsoever, just using them to see what would happen.
Yeah.
So once again, we're talking about a spiritual process of initiation induced by whatever means. It could be drugs, it could be hypnosis, behavior modification, or anything else. And then these subjects dropped. You know, no follow-up whatsoever, no spiritual context.
Yeah.
People in the stages of initiation now walking on the streets and trying to interpret the world anew with this new information and being totally unprepared and unequipped to deal with the fallout.
My God, that is to me dabbling in the occult, so to speak.
It certainly is.
Yeah, not knowing what you're doing, and these of course, as you say, can I guess release tremendous forces, considering you know that the power of the conscious and unconscious mind in that sense. I mean, this is fascinating stuff. But Peter, I mean, we're out of time for this segment here, but just let me say thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciated you taking the time to be here. This has been an excellent discussion, but I would like to again finish off with you telling our listeners how to get your books and about your website, of course.
I appreciate it. My website is www.sinisterforces.info, I-N-F-O. The book, of course, is Sinister Forces. You can get it at most of the book-selling websites, like Amazon.com has it, or you can go directly to the publisher. You can call us in the United States at 1-800-556-2012. Or simply go to our website or go to Amazon.com or some cases local bookstores actually dare to carry Sinister Force. So good luck. And if you have a problem finding it, simply send me an email at www.sinisterforces.info.
Excellent. So everybody check it out, sinisterforces.info. And again, we've just brushed on these topics here today. And at some point, maybe we could do this again, Peter. I would love to have you back sometime. Yeah. Okay.
I'd be pleased. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming on. Thank you.